I'm going to start off by asking a question,
which is not asked in standard textbooks on solid-state physics. So in fact, you're given a very misleading impression of what a solid is in most texts on solids. And the question is, how do real solids, that is 99.99999% of all solids that you see around you in the universe, behave at low energy? If you look in the text, they'll tell you either about some pure lattice with a regular structure, or maybe they'll tell you about an insulator with one or two impurities, or they'll tell you about a superfluid, which is completely pure. And so the impression that one gets is that everything is very, very simple at low energies. Maybe there's a few excitations floating around.
Sorry about that.
Just heard one of them go by there. And so it's really quite simple. In fact, the picture of the standard textbook picture of a low temperature solid is basically completely homogeneous with a few delocalized excitations flying around like photons or electrons. But in fact, if you do experiments, you find that's exactly the opposite. As you get to lower and lower temperatures in metals or insulators, and as we'll see, even superfluids, supersolids, we find that things get more and more complicated. And the reason is, well, first of all, let me just say what you see. Here we have some typical results for glass. And this was actually pretty pure glass. These are experiments done by Doug Oshroff. And they show that as you go to low temperatures, the behavior of the system becomes completely dominated by, interacting two-level systems, which in this case are some kind of topological defect. And some remarkable things happen. This is showing you the capacitance of the system as a function of applied electric field. And as you lower the temperature, it starts to develop this structure. This is the so-called dipolar hole, which you can see, in fact, in experiments on hundreds and hundreds of different systems. There's a Review of Modern Physics article by Zeller, I believe, recently, which catalogs some 200 simple, pure systems and what they do. And this is the sort of thing that they do. Okay? And you see this in all the properties. This is the sound velocity. This is the dielectric constant and so forth. Now, the standard reaction of people, if they're not low temperature physicists to this, is to say, well, this is just junk. Actually, it's not. It happens in a pure system. The phenomena that I'm talking about recur over and over again. Here's a very surprising result on the right. This shows the result of quantum Monte Carlo calculations done by Boninsegni et al. Recently on supersolid helium-4. They simulated the dynamics of the helium-4 atoms, and they found the relaxation times basically looked like a glass in this system, and that the superfluid density was not at all uniform. This is rather remarkable to see in a system which is actually solid, which shows finite superfluid density at low temperatures, to see that it actually has glassy correlation functions. Now, for those of you who don't know, the long supersolid was finally discovered by Moses Chan 2 years ago. That is in solid crystalline helium-4. Why is this happening? Well, the standard model for this is the interacting two-level system. It basically says that because of boundaries, long-range interactions, frustrating interactions, which are basically almost always there, unless you pick a really unusual system, there is a pile-up of states at low energies, and that this can be described by a model in which you have a set of two-level systems, which are these Pauli matrices here, which have random local fields on them, typically, and which interact. And the very interesting thing about this model is that even if these interactions are small, as you lower the energy scale, they grow. So, for example, in a typical piece of glass, they're very, very weak at a temperature of, say, 50 Kelvin. They're typically several hundred times smaller than these fields, but when you go to very low temperatures, they renormalize and get larger, and so eventually they dominate. And this is why we see this peculiar behavior. There's all sorts of interesting discussions of how one should treat this, which I'm not going to talk about now. Now, why am I telling you this? Well, the reason is that most of the time we don't really care what happens at 50 or 20 millikelvin. But when one's working in quantum nanoscience, you actually care a great deal. These are some of the qubits, or candidates for qubits, that many of us know and love. On the bottom left here, we have magnetic candidates. I think that various people are going to talk about these. Is there a pointer, by any chance? Oh, a stick. Excellent. This is one particular magnetic molecule. It's essentially a large spin. The advantage of these is that they can be made in a very well-characterized way. I believe George Christou will tell you about that. Here's a chain of these things. These are the superconducting qubits, which you'll also hear about, and I'm sure that Bob Clark will tell us about spins and semiconductors. Now, all of these designs for qubits have a really big problem, and that's decoherence. And that's why I started talking about the two-level systems that one has. Transferring this has altered the position of all the text. Anyway, now there's been a lot of discussion of decoherence for qubits over the years, and the model that's usually used, or has been used until recently to describe this, basically says, well, let's take a qubit, which is a two-level system described by a Pauli matrix tau, and couple it to a bath of oscillators here, which are these labeled by q and have coordinates x sub q. And then we couple the qubit to the oscillators by a coupling, which is linear in the oscillator coordinate. This is the so-called spin boson model, and there's an awful lot of papers that have been written about it. Now, the crucial point is that in the spin boson model, these oscillators model delocalized modes interacting with qubit. Phonons, electrons, photons, magnons, spinons, holons, whatever. They're delocalized. However, we've just seen before that in reality there will also be localized excitations, which in fact behave as two-level systems most of the time. There's a large variety of physical two-level systems, everything from real spins, like nuclear spins or paramagnetic impurities, to other systems which, because they behave like two-level systems, can be treated as though they were spins, or spin halves. These include defects, various kinds of topological defects, dislocations, and so on. And in many cases, one doesn't actually know what they are. So in the experiments that I showed you at the very beginning by Oshroff, this is pure glass, but we actually don't really know what these two-level systems are because of the very complex structure of the glass and the topological constraints and the frustrating interactions. But nevertheless, we can model a qubit coupled to this bath of two-level excitations, this spin bath. And the way you do it is, well, you start off with your qubit. I'd like you to ignore this. This is for aficionados. So just imagine that we have our qubit here on the first line, just like we had in the last slide. So this is a transverse field, a longitudinal field. And then we let the qubit tau interact with the bath of two-level system, the spin bath, the sigma k. And there'll be direct interactions between them. These are supposed to be vectors. And there'll be these external fields. You saw that at the beginning. This is the spin bath with its interactions and the interaction with the qubit. So one knows that one can write the effect of Hamiltonian for the qubit interacting with the spin bath in this form, even if you have no idea what the spins in the spin bath are. In other words, what are these two-level systems? Of course, you may not know what these couplings are or these fields, but you know that you can write it in this form. Okay. Now, it turns out that in most cases, you cannot map this to the spin boson model. In fact, it behaves very, very differently. So let me tell you a bit about how it behaves. The spin boson model has a behavior which is intuitively relatively easy to understand. Anyone who knows anything about quantum optics knows that a two-level atom interacting with a photon bath will have its dynamics decohered because of stimulated and spontaneous transitions in the bath, and also because of various renormalization effects. What happens here? Well, the most obvious effect of these bath spins these two-level systems is that by internal fluctuations themselves, they'll cause noise on the two-level qubit. So there's background environmental noise, and that's what's shown here. I'm showing, if you like, as a function of time, the way in which the effective quasi-adiabatic levels of the qubit are fluctuating in time. But there's actually a much more important kind of decoherence in this system, which has no analog in the spin boson model at all. And it's the following. Supposing I take one of my Bath spins, one of my Bath two-level systems, and ask what its dynamics is. Well, if the qubit happens to be up, then there'll be some field acting on the Bath spin in some direction with some magnitude. And the Bath spin will, we can imagine that it starts off being aligned with this field. But then the qubit flips, and so this field changes, and the Bath spin will start to process around the new field. And that will go on for a while, and then the qubit will flip back. And so now the Bath spin is going to have to start reprocessing around the new field, and so on and so on. This is a classical picture, but of course what it tells you immediately is that the Bath spin, the environmental two-level system, is now entangled with the qubit. Okay? Its wave function is entangled with that of the qubit. It's very simple. Notice that there's no exchange of energy here. This is pure perception. So this is decoherence without dissipation. It turns out that in basically all models that anyone's investigated so far of this, this processional decoherence dominates completely. So I'm really not going to mention much about the others. Okay, there isn't time. So it's a rather simple mechanism, and this, by the way, is the general Hamiltonian. I guess I introduced it before. So now I'd like to say a little bit about how this works out in the real world. There's one first really important thing is that the effect of these two-level systems is always important at low energies, whereas the effect of the oscillator bath is always important, more important at high energies. Why? Because the phase space of the oscillators increases with energy and temperature, whereas, as I showed you at the beginning, these two-level systems like to pile up at low energies. What this means is, and this is just showing you an example, is that as you lower the effective energy scale of your qubit, the oscillators will go away, whether they be photons or phonons or even electrons. But eventually, and this is for an example of a magnetic system, the two-level systems in the environment will start to come in. This is for a magnetic system, so it's usually nuclear spins that dominate. So there's a region here where decoherence will be the minimum. We call this the coherence window. The energy scales are shown here for a typical magnetic system. Typically the photons' energy scales maybe 100 Kelvin, the nuclear spins maybe 1 millikelvin. And so you see that somewhere in here, around about 1 Kelvin, it depends on the system, this window can move around, you get the optimal behavior. Now I'm going to show you two examples of that that have been studied really in some detail. The first one is the lithium-holmium system. This is the so-called archetypal quantum spin glass, and I believe that Gabe Apley is going to talk about it at this conference. So you'll hear a lot more about this system. It's a rather important system in condensed matter physics because it's a first approximation. You can treat the holmium ions as being described by a set of icing spins, but two-level systems. I mean, the actual holmium ions have spin 8, but the very, very strong crystal fields truncate the behavior to a set of two-level systems at low energies whose dynamics is driven by a transverse magnetic field. So this is a transverse term. So you apply a transverse field and you get an effective splitting between these two levels. And then there are dipolar interactions between these spins, and their effect is longitudinal, again, because the crystal fields more or less get rid of the other terms. Well, not quite. And actually, this has been treated for some 15 years now as the archetypal quantum icing system. And it shows a quantum spin glass phase, which is very interesting. Well, it's been remarkable work recently. I'm just going to tell you about the theoretical work. Apley will publish a science paper a few months ago on the experimental side. You actually find that this picture is completely wrong because of the nuclear spins. There's a profound effect of them. And the first one is that instead of this transverse effective field going like the square of the applied field, it actually goes like a very much more, much higher power. And this doesn't start to kick in until you get to a strong applied magnetic field, roughly 2 Tesla. This already explains one paradox in the system, which is that the effective scale of transverse fields, the energy scale of transverse fields in the system, nobody could ever understand why it was roughly 20 times higher than the temperature scale. And this is the reason. But the other thing is that for the first time, when you include these, you can actually explain the phase diagram of the quantum spin glass in the system, again, because of these big renormalizations. So this was published very recently by myself and Moshe Schechter, who is working in Vancouver, having come from Israel. The other thing is that the decoherence hole, the coherence window, is at very low temperatures in this system. So unfortunately, this system has been touted for some time now as a candidate for a quantum computer or for doing qubits, and there's been papers on quantum annealing and so forth in it, but decoherence will not be possible to eliminate until you get the temperature that turns out of roughly 5 millikelvin. Here's another system that's been studied a great deal, and I believe that experiments on this will actually be described by Andrea Morello. They were done in Leiden. Here, I just wanted to show you the coherence hole. What you do is you apply a strong transverse field, and that freezes out the nuclear spins, and it also increases the splitting of the qubits, and so the decoherence from nuclear spins comes rocketing down if you apply a transverse field. This dimensionless parameter is, if you like, the inverse of the Q factor for this qubit. So this is 1, and this is 10 to the minus 6. So this means actually a Q factor of pi times 10 to the 6th. And so you see that the contribution of the nuclear spins to the decoherence comes down incredibly fast as you apply this field. And unfortunately, there is still a coherent window, and that's because the photon is about to come in. This is an oscillator bath. So you're always going to get some kind of oscillator bath coming up. In other words, there's no pot of gold here. Eventually, the oscillator bath will kick in, and so it's only a window. Now, these systems have been studied by many different experimental groups, and you'll hear, I guess, some talk about that in this conference. So, the main point I wanted to make is that there are ways of getting rid of the decoherence here. This coherence window. Is probably a rather interesting possibility because you see these numbers are rather nice. This is a Q factor of roughly 5 times 10 to the 5, for example. I think this experiment will be done pretty soon by actually people in this room. There are a whole bunch of other experiments in these magnetic systems. I guess I haven't got time to mention these. This, for example, is the Apley results. He has a paper in Science recently called Quantum phase transitions in the spin bath, and I guess he'll tell you about that. There's an awful lot of experiments which have actually examined quantitatively the way in which the nuclear spins cause relaxation and decoherence in these systems. The agreement between theory and experiment in some cases is really quite remarkable. And the reason, of course, is that we know what the hyperfine interactions are in these systems. We know what the G factor of the nuclear spins is and so forth. So all of those coupling constants in that effective Hamiltonian I told you about at the beginning, we actually know them. So we can do calculations with no adjustable parameters, and they better agree with the experiments. I'm not going to say so much about the squids. The reason is that in the squids, it's a very different situation. We really often don't know what the two-level systems are or how they couple to, for example, the flux in the squid. Nakamura, who I guess was last I heard trapped in Tokyo Airport by snow, is supposed to talk about this. I think John Martinez will probably have something to say about it too, because this is taken from a recent paper of his, which shows the two-level systems interacting with the superconducting qubit. Calculations, again, indicate that you have a coherence window in these superconducting qubits. And so the various references there you can look at. Okay. Now, that was the first part of the talk, essentially telling you about the way in which two-level systems in the environment are a serious problem for any kind of quantum nanoscience where you need to get coherence. Moreover, they're an inevitable problem because there's always going to be two-level systems in the environment and they're always going to cause problems at low energy, but that there are ways of eliminating to a considerable extent their effects. I want to slightly change the topic now. You see that the kind of models that we're looking at here are very interesting for a theorist. The reason is that these models, which are sometimes called models of quantum dissipation, can be mapped to other models which are of interest to people in totally different fields. And that's what I'm going to finish off by telling you about. So the first example I'm going to briefly discuss is the model which is sometimes called the SL2Z model, at least in the US. It's essentially a model of interacting vortices and charges, and there are a large number of systems which can be mapped to this in one way or another with a greater or less degree of accuracy. One, for example, is a Josephson junction array. The bath here, an oscillator bath, is coming from quasiparticles and photons. Whereas, for example, Su-Cheng Zhang can probably tell you about, there's been a lot of discussion since the proposal by Bob Lawson in 1984 that one can map the quantum Hall system, the 2D quantum Hall fluid, to the same model. In fact, this shows a phase diagram proposed by Zhang, Kibelson, et al. For this system, and there's been a lot of experiments showing this sort of structure. More recently, there's been discussions of similar ideas for Josephson junction arrays modeling anyon quantum computers, topological quantum computers. In many ways, the archetype of this, all of these models, is what's called the dissipative Hofstadter system. This is where you take a two-dimensional lattice and you have a particle hopping around on it, coupled to some background bath. But there's a uniform flux, a uniform field threading all of the plaquettes of this lattice. Without the background bath, this is just the famous Hofstadter butterfly. With the bath, you get a phase diagram, which is, the first investigations of this were done by string theorists like Kurt Kahle, and they proposed a phase diagram. This is the flux per plaquette. This is the coupling, the dissipated coupling to the environment. Inside these circles, the system is supposed to be delocalized, that is, the particle move around. But between them, it's localized. And you see, we have this extraordinary nested structure, which was actually first described by John Cardy in his investigations of the theta vacuum in 1984. So the first thing I want to remark on is that I've been having a lot of fun, entirely because of PyTP, working with string theorists recently, because they're extremely interested in all of these models. The reason is that it turns out that the vacuum of a very general class of string theories can be modeled by this. And we found some, this is myself and Gordon Semenoff and Taijin Lee, two formidable string theorists, we've actually found all sorts of interesting things which indicate that a lot of standard results in quantum dissipation theory actually may be incorrect. The Schmidt model, for example, turns out that there is a symmetry that is forced on this by string theory, which is essentially that you have to have periodicity in the oscillator bath as well, which makes sense. One has umklapp processes, for example, if the bath is coming from photons. Turns out that changes the results. We know that because Gordon found an exact solution. In the dissipative Hofstadter model, it turns out that one can also find an exact solution on this line. It's something that I found. And it turns out the phase diagram proposed by Cullen and company actually doesn't work, and the duality is broken down, something which Ian Affleck also suspected from his investigations of another model, which maps onto this. That is a model where you have three Luttinger liquids intersecting at a point where there's a flux. So this is a very nice example of the way in which extraordinarily different parts of theoretical physics can be related to each other in a very fruitful way, which I guess is one of the goals of PyTP. And so I'm going to finish off with another interesting quantum dissipation model. This is the so-called quantum walk system. And I've been having a lot of fun with Gerard in the last month or two looking at this, because he immediately realized that the stuff that we were doing could be applied to a whole variety of systems. So this is work initially by myself and Nikolai Bukoffiev, and then by Andrew Hines, who probably many of you here know, who's now working at, who's a PyTP postdoc fellow, and Gerard. And so the idea is very simple, that quantum computations can be mapped to walks on some graph. So any condensed matter, so physicists are familiar with this, it's just hopping around on a lattice of some kind. This is a typical graph. This is another one that was studied in some detail by people like Richard Cleave. The idea is that these points, the nodes on this graph, represent points in the Hilbert space of the quantum information processing system. What happens now if you analyze decoherence? Again, we found some extraordinary results. It turns out that quantum diffusion on these graphs, when you couple to a spin bath, it can actually be, it shows super diffusion. That is, some part of the density matrix of the quantum computer will always behave ballistically. In other words, will not show decoherence. Now, this is a result we're still trying to understand. But again, it turns out to be exact. So that's where I'm going to finish. So I think there's the interest here is that there's an awful lot of surprises in this field that I've finished off with couple. And so the question of exactly how to understand decoherence in quantum information processing systems, and in fact in solid-state physics in general, is by no means over. In fact, it's just beginning, I think. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Phil. And we have time for a couple of questions. Floyd?
Just picking up on what you just said, super diffusion holds for that particular Hamiltonian, but do you have any ideas of that will hold for other
classes? Yeah, actually, the reason I wrote this one here is because it's fairly short. But you can add a whole bunch of terms to it, and the same result survives. I can give you the preprint.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions to folks?
When you talked about the spin boson model, you seem to be emphasizing that it was describing delocalized expansion.
No. I didn't actually say anything about the spin boson model except to mention it.
Okay. So
when I was talking about this, this is the dissipated Hofstede model.
Right back at the very beginning, when you're justifying the spin bath model.
So did I say? No, I said that the oscillators in this model, mm-hmm. they refer to delocalized excitations. They model photons or protons or magnons or spinons. They do not model localized excitations like nuclear spins or paramagnetic impurities or two-level defects. That's got nothing to do with the behavior of the qubit. The qubit coupled to this oscillator bath can be localized or delocalized depending on the strength of the coupling and so forth.
So my question was more just that couldn't you just, your index, for example, Q there, you don't need to really know anything about, you could have localized phonons. I guess what I mean, in terms of the extent, the wave function of the phonon could be spatially localized.
Yeah, but at that point you have to worry about the following question. What is the strength of the coupling? See, if these excitations are delocalized, then you can argue very generally that the strength of the coupling will go like 1 over root n, where n is the number of oscillators. Okay, this is a standard wave function normalization argument. The size of the box is of order n, so the overlap goes like 1 over root n. At that point, you have a weak coupling result. These couplings are weak, and all of the calculations in the spin boson model assume that coupling is weak. It has to be, otherwise none of the calculations are correct. Now, the problem is if you have a localized phonon, you have absolutely no guarantee that the coupling is weak, and actually it's often very strong. And then you can't map it to a spin boson model.
Any other questions before? Well, if not, let's thank Phil again. Our next speaker is Professor Michelle Simmons from University of New South Wales, and her talk is